I was trying to find a video. I couldn't legally download one, so I've been a good boy. Okay, in the song, Pharrell Williams sings that he's happy and he's not going to let anything change that. No matter what people say, he's not going to let them drag him down. And in the chorus, he invites us to join him. Here's the word of the chorus. I'm not going to sing it, okay? Because I'm happy, clap along now if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy, clap along now if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm happy, clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Because I'm happy, clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. It's a cheerful, feel-good song. Put it into YouTube when you get home if you don't know it. Partly made famous by featuring that film with the little irritating yellow characters, Despicable Me. And it captures something of our society's approach to happiness. In particular, a couple of lines. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. And clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Happiness in our society is the thing people search for. In many ways, it's the highest good, particularly in our individual culture, that actually says it's about you achieving what you want. Knowing what makes you happy matters. And in the song, he carries on that once you've found it, you mustn't let others bring you down. No matter what they say, you will stay happy. But actually, the song also poses the question of us, do we know what brings us happiness? I wonder how you'd answer that. What is the thing that brings you happiness? Now, I think the preacher of Ecclesiastes would agree with a lot of that song. Happiness is worth seeking. And when we find it, we should do what he does, which is rejoice and invite others to come and join us and find it too. Happiness does matter. And the book of Ecclesiastes, in many ways, it is about the search for happiness and joy. But not happiness as an end in itself. Not happiness, as Pharrell Williams sings, as the truth. Now, last week we looked at the first 11 verses, and in many ways that's the kind of key for understanding the whole book of Ecclesiastes. So if you weren't here last week, it might be worth listening again. The recording's not brilliant, but you might kind of pick up some of the key things. So, for example, that word meaningless that we tend to think, oh, what's he saying? It's actually the word vapor or breath, something you can't grasp hold of, something you can't keep. And when he talks about under the sun, he's talking about life in a world that is Eden ruined. And as we go through the book, we're going to see that he's going to try and knock down the things we are tempted to find happiness in just under the sun. Because he doesn't want us to live life trying to hold on to a breath. So let's dive into this passage this morning. And look at verses 12 and 15. He tells us about his search for happiness. But right from the outset, he tells us that it was hard, it was unsatisfying, and it was frustration. Look at what he says, verse 13, at the end of the verse. What a heavy burden God has laid on the human race. As he looks at the world, as he looks at trying to find happiness, he concludes, well, it is burdensome. Life now is a burden. Look at verse 14. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. And you kind of think, do you know, was he just having a bad day? Is he one of those Eeyore people? You know, never smiling, always looking at the negative. Now, it helps if we understand his perspective here. And look at verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. He is looking at something that is not as it should be. As he looks at the world, it is crooked and it should be straight. He has in him the desires of Eden as somebody made in Adam's image. He has in him the desire to find joy and happiness. But as he looks at the world, it's crooked. It's lacking. And he can't find those things fulfilled now. One of the things to say here, what he's saying here, is that he is honestly searching for meaning. He is not looking at the world like a Disney film. He's not looking at it as if it's a paradise. He's looking in a real world, a world of toil and labour, a good world gone bad. He's not looking back to the good old days. You know that phrase you hate as kids and then you find yourself using as parents? Well, in my day, he's not saying, you know, as I often lament, you know, football was better in my day when it wasn't all about money. You know, all those kind of things. He's looking now at the real world. He's also not doing what the other thing we tend to do is imagine an ideal future. A utopia where everything will be okay. He's saying you can find joy in the real world, and that's what I'm searching for. I am searching for happiness, but in the midst of a broken and ruined Eden. He's not saying we have to escape the world. He wants to help us find joy despite the struggle and the suffering of the world we live in. Happiness is elusive. Sin will leave us longing for something different in a world made crooked and lacking. But the question he wants to pose to us, particularly in this little section, is one of our dangers is we find ourselves, if you take the Pharrell Williams metaphor on, clapping along to the wrong thing. Thinking we've found happiness in stuff, when actually it's just temporary. It will disappear in the glare of fallen Eden's reality. Now, Ecclesiastes is not an easy book. We're going to see that as we go through. But it is God's gift to us. Because he doesn't want us to go from temporary happiness to temporary happiness to temporary happiness. He wants us to know true, lasting happiness. That lasts not just when the sun is shining and it's nice, but when the sun is baking down in the midst of suffering and hardship. And here we get his wisdom. So a couple of things to look at this morning. What's this? Phil pops the slide on. What's that?
Is it quartz?
Oh, it's not. At least you said gold. It looks like gold, doesn't it? Do you know, you would find it where you normally find gold. It's actually iron pyrite. That's fool's gold. Okay? Prospectors often mistook it for the real thing. They thought there are cases of them kind of packing bags, saddlebags full, and driving miles back to stake a claim and then getting back, thinking they'd made it rich, even spending some of their future earnings, and then discovering actually it was worthless. That's the first lesson the preacher has for us this morning. Don't settle for fool's gold. And it's there in 1:16 to 2:11. The preacher wants to show us that the things we think will bring us happiness, that we think are gold, that are treasure, are actually fool's gold. They will ultimately disappoint us. And he looks at two particular areas. The first he starts with his education, verses 16 to 18, and then he looks at pleasure, chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. So he starts verses 16 to 18 with education. That's interesting, isn't it? We live in a society that loves education. It's the way of aspiration. It's the answer to society's ills. Better education will cause the crime rates to fall, teenage pregnancy to decline, end prejudice and hatred, and lead to a better life for us as individuals and produce a better society. No pressure, teachers, but that's the expectation. That's why it's a key issue in the upcoming election, isn't it? You just listen out over the next few weeks to how often that's going to be mentioned. Education matters. Education is the ideal. Education is the key to unlocking a better life. But the preacher wants us to recognise education has its limits. It is good, but it is not somewhere to sink your search for happiness or your sense of identity. So look at verses 16 to 17. He diligently pursues education, doesn't he? I said to myself, look, I have grown in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. Now, wouldn't you love to have him as your child? There's no nagging. There's no need to check the homework planner. There's no need to have rewards or punishments. He never got attention. He diligently worked and worked and worked and worked. He pursues knowledge as the way to happiness. He sinks his identity into it. How many letters can I get after my name? But we need to hear his conclusion. Because this is one of those things that I think in our society is very easy to have as one of our idols. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Now, you won't hear those words from a careers advisor. But actually, here he is. We need to let this sink deep into our hearts and transform us. Because we too readily treat this as like finding gold, like finding treasure. It's why people do everything they can to secure the best possible school for their children. Why parents push their kids and hire tutors for year 6 SATs. They've just been, haven't they? The percentage of kids who have a tutor who do 4 to 8 hours extra with them a week is ridiculous. Why? Because somehow we believe education will lead to better qualifications, that will lead to a better standard of life, a better job, that will provide security and enable them to buy the things that lead to happiness. And I ask you this morning, those of you who are parents, what do you dream for your children? What sort of life do you picture them enjoying? And how do you plan to help them attain it? One of the dangers for us as parents is sinking our identity into education, putting our hopes for our kids firmly in that, looking for meaning and happiness in that. Now, let me just say, the preacher's not saying education is evil, but he's saying it can't do what we're tempted to want it to do. It is good, but it has limits. It doesn't bring happiness. In fact, it's fascinating, isn't it, verse 18? For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. It's good, but only if we keep it in its place. It can't produce real joy. It does just pose the question of us, do we recognise its limits? Do we talk to our children as if it has limits? Do we order life as if there are limits to what education can do? That it isn't the ultimate means of securing happiness? Do we spend as much time teaching them about God as about addition, chemical reactions, or the correct use of the apostrophe? There's a challenge there, isn't there? Because our kids will not just hear our words, they will read our actions. So education is a good, but it is not where happiness is found. And only when we get that right will we put it in its proper place. So secondly, start chapter 2, he leaves university, if you want, and he heads out into the world looking for joy in pleasure, verse 1. Come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. And he dives right in. He gives himself over to it. And he tries 8 different ways of testing pleasure as he seeks happiness. So look at verse 2, he tries comedy and humour. Verse 3, he tries alcohol. Verse 4, those of you who are into Channel 4, he tries grand designs. Verses 5 and 6, those who are into long walks and gardening, he tries nature. Verse 8, he tries music. Verse 8 again, he tries sex. Verse 9, he tries fame, reputation, and kind of the party circuit. And it isn't that he tries each of these things once, dipping his toe into it and then leaving. He plunges in head first. Look at how he sums it up, verse 10. I denied myself nothing my heart desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. In other words, when I did these, boy, did I go for it. Money was no object whatsoever. I will pursue happiness to its nth degree in each of these things. Drink more than anyone else, have more wives than anyone else, more slaves than anyone else. That's what he's saying. I will absolutely exhaust them and see if I can find happiness. Now, it's worth noticing what he says. He doesn't say there is no happiness in those things. Look at the end of verse 10. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for all my toil. This is what he's saying, there is happiness in these things. To deny that is to lie. That would be dishonest. And let me say, I think too often people discount the gospel because they hear us as saying there is no joy or happiness in anything else. Now, that's not what the Bible teaches. The preacher is honest. There is joy to be found in those things. There is happiness to be found in those things. But look at verse 11. Here's the perspective. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Do you see what he's saying? Look, there is happiness in these things. You know, imagine for a minute, you labour for months to build yourself the most exquisite, amazing garden ever. And then you sit out there on a sunny Sunday evening in your deck chair or your hammock with a cold bud and just admire the beauty of things plant. There is joy and happiness in there, isn't there? But look what he's saying. He's saying that is only temporary. It doesn't last. Just when you think you have it, it floats away. Take the garden image. It doesn't always stay like that, does it? What happens? Weeds come up. What are you going to do? You've got to weed it. Okay, things get a bit overgrown. The kids play football in there and wreck every single plant that's delicate. You know, someone else's cat comes in and decides it's going to scratch a load of stuff. Yeah, things don't stay perfect. Even if they did, actually, we would find ourselves wanting more, wanting to redesign it. You always need more of it, is what he's saying. He's not saying there's no happiness, he's saying there is happiness, but we always have to keep topping it up. More humour, more alcohol, more building, more seeing something new, having more, hearing more, more sexual partners, better sex, to be better known, to be at more parties, to have more fame, on and on and on and on and on. There is delight and happiness, but it's only temporary. It doesn't last. You have to keep on topping it up. Now, I think, interestingly, the preacher only realizes this in verse 11 when he does something very specific. Look at how it starts. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, what does he do? He stops the busy, and he steps back to look at what it's achieving. Now, isn't that interesting? He immerses himself in it, and he thinks he's finding joy in it until he steps back and looks at the long term. Am I really finding joy in these things? Will they still be giving me joy in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years? Are they worth the effort I'm putting in? Are they giving me happiness, or are they really bad masters? See, I think that concept's quite foreign to us. We often just keep pursuing. Busy, distracted and ongoing. We need to learn to do what he does, which is stop, stand back, look at life and ask, what have I gained from my pursuit of this? What has it benefited me in the long term? Did you know there are some simple tests of gold? So if you had a piece of gold, I haven't, okay, and a piece of iron pyrite, you could really easily test it, because with copper you can scratch real gold. You can't scratch iron pyrite. Or if you smack it with a hammer, real gold will flatten. Try it with your wedding ring if you dare, okay? It will flatten. But iron pyrite will produce sparks. See, when you stand back and look at it for what it is and test it, you can find out. And that's what the preacher is encouraging us to do. He says, look, I've tested these. You don't need to. I've found out what's fool's gold, what will provide some happiness but not lasting happiness. I wonder which of those things he's listed are we tempted to believe will bring us real happiness? Which are we tempted to pursue? As you step back this morning and just take a minute to think, how much real happiness is there? How much of it lasts? And will we be humble enough to listen to him and his wisdom? Here's the second thing he says to us this morning in verses 12 to 23 of chapter 2. He says this, look reality in the eye. Now, as he moves on in verses 12 onwards, it looks like he's coming back to his topic of wisdom again. And in some ways he is, except he's looking at it with a different lens. He's looking at it through the lens of ultimate reality. And look what he says in verse 14. The wise have eyes in their heads while fools walk in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless, for the wise and the fool will not be remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying, look, these things aren't bad. He says, look, it's better to be wise than to be a fool. But he says, ultimately, we all die. And we need to reconcile and live life with that fact in view. Now, he applies that truth to himself, verse 15. That he's not afraid to look at his own mortality. He doesn't want to pretend he's immortal like we so often do. And as he contemplates the reality of death, he is frustrated. That's where the words of verses 17 to 23 flow from. It's his frustration as he looks at the world, as he looks at all the things he's done. Death is the great leveller. And verses 17 to 23 are some of the most depressing in the Bible. Let me just pick out some of the phrases that he uses. Verse 17, so I hated life. Verse 18, I hated all the things that I had toiled for. 20, my heart began to despair. 19 and 23 repeats the phrase, this too is meaningless. There's a sense in which he's just, as he looks at death, as he confronts life's ultimate reality, as if he's being sucked down this kind of vortex. What's the point? Everything I've worked for is just going to get left to someone else. I always say to my parents, spend your inheritance because you never know how we use it. You know, spend it. Go on holiday. Do good things. That's basically what he's saying. Look, I could work really, really hard. I could create the best kingdom ever. And then I will hand it to my son who might ruin it all. Kind of thinking he's looking back at the history of Israel there. You go from David to Solomon, and then what happens with the next king? The kingdom divides in two. Why? Because someone foolishly takes the wrong advice. And this kingdom that's been built up and is more wealthy than anything gets split. And ultimately, in not a very long time historically, both parts end up in exile. From the most important kingdom to people carried away and cities left in ruin. You see, he's saying, look, this will be your experience too. No matter what you do, no matter what you achieve, you can't take it with you when you go. The pharaohs used to think that, didn't they? And that's been a great help to those who are effectively tomb raiders there. None of it's gone, it's all still there. People have just taken it and sold it off. You can't take it with you. Now I wonder if some of the language here surprises us. The little phrase, so I hated life, is not one I think we expect to hear in the Bible. Particularly not when you bear in mind every word in the Bible is the Spirit-inspired word of God. But let's be honest, don't we sometimes feel like that? Don't you find yourself sometimes frustrated, grieving, just at the end of your tether? And God in Ecclesiastes says to us, sometimes it is right to vent your frustration with Eden ruined. It is right sometimes to say, I hate life with all its futility and grief and despair and death. I hate the ruin that sin has made of Eden. That is a right thing sometimes for us to say. And to come to God and say to him. But notice something. At no point does the preacher lay the blame at God's door. At no point does he say, I hate God, because he knows his theology. He knows this is not the world the way God made it. This is the world the way sin has ruined it. Death and frustration should lead us to hate sin and the ruin it brings. Not just other sin, not just sin in general, but our sin too. Looking reality in the eye will lead us to have to grapple with the nature of sin and suffering. It will lead us to say that actually there are things in this world that we hate, that are not right, that are wrong. But actually grappling with looking reality in the eye also teaches something else. Blaise Pascal wrote, being unable to cure death, wretchedness and ignorance, men have decided, in order to be happy, not to think about such things. Isn't that interesting? Let me read that again. Being unable to cure death, wretchedness and ignorance, men have decided, in order to be happy, not to think about such things. That's our society, isn't it? We think about the happy, not the sad. We think about finding experience, not walking through suffering. You think about the Pharrell Williams song, that's one of the lines, I'm not going to let others bring me down. I'm not going to listen to what others say about how hard their life is. I'm just going to keep on topping up my happiness. We ignore what we don't like. We pretend death isn't there, that it's not waiting for us. You know, it was ironic this week, as I was writing that very sentence, the phone went. I answered it. It was one of those annoying call centres. And it was a lady saying, "Oh, Mr. Goodham, we wanted to come send someone around to talk to you about the fact that when you are old and have to go into care, you'll have to sell your house to pay for it." And I said, "Look, I'm young. I don't need to think about that yet." And then I put the phone down, and then I turned back to writing this and thought, isn't that interesting? I am young. I don't need to think about it. And yet actually he is saying, look, until we've looked reality in the eye, the reality of life and suffering and our death, we will find it hard to live well. We will avoid it rather than being apprenticed and trained by it. We won't be taught by it. Instead, we'll keep on investing in the temporary and the passing, in things that were never designed to bear the weight of the hopes we're tempted to put on them, because we're trying to steer away from looking at sin and suffering and the ruin of Eden and death. He poses us a question here. Can we honestly say we have dared to look death in the eye and then live in the light of it? Do we honestly look at the ruin of Eden and allow ourselves to feel its effect, its frustrations and its pains? To at times say, I hate life. Do we allow it to teach us not to seek happiness just in the here and now? So we don't live life as if this life is all there is. The preacher slows down and he asks us to slow down, to put aside the distractions, to turn the phones off, to stop channel surfing on the TV, to stop entertaining ourselves as an avoidance strategy, and instead to look at real life now, to see the world, look it in the eye, to come to terms with it, to see the brokenness, the temporary satisfactions, to reason with life in light of our death, and to let it apprentice us into how to live wisely. Have we done that? What difference would it make to the things we invest in, the things we do? Here's the last thing this morning, and you'll be pleased. This is the uptick, okay? If they're the down, this is the up. Verses 24 to 26. This is where he invites us to clap along with him. So it kind of poses the question, so how do we live? If at times we're going to hate life, if at times it seems meaningless, how do we live? Where do we find happiness that lasts, identity that satisfies? Is it all future? So life now is the hard chores and the difficulty. Is he going to say life eternal is where joy is found? Life here is like school term full of drudgery and work, whereas life eternal is like the blissful school-free days of summer. No, that's not what he says. Look what he says, verse 24. People can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now here he is, and he's grounding this kind of joy and happiness in a very earthy, everyday place. He wants us, and God wants us, to clap along because we find joy here and now. A joy that flows from knowing God. A joy that flows from knowing the God who made us to experience joy and happiness. The God who created a bountiful and beautiful Eden and declared it good. But in Eden, all of the joy flowed from knowing God. Everything else was a side effect. And so even amid Eden ruined, in knowing God, we find the ability to enjoy and find happiness rightly in the things around us. It all feels a bit mundane and ordinary, doesn't it, in verse 24? People can do nothing better than eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. It all seems very everyday. Joy is found in the simple gifts of a good, generous God and receiving them thankfully from his hand. What he's saying is not making them the source of joy and happiness. Ironically, they're some of the very things that he sets out as pleasures to look at and concludes they're not the means of happiness. But now he says when we get the relationship right, when we get God in the right place and we're enjoying and we know God, then actually we are free to enjoy those things and find joy in them because we receive them as good gifts of our Creator. What if food wasn't just fuel, but a daily joy gifted to us by a good God? How would that change how we ate meals? How would that change what you ate, when you ate, who you ate with? How would that change how much time you gave? If you didn't think of it as refueling, but as this is a loving gift from my Father to bring me joy. What if work was not where we looked for meaning and identity, but instead we viewed it as God's good gift to enable us to serve others faithfully and be generous with our produce? How would that change tomorrow morning? How would that change your approach to your colleagues, your pupils, your patients? Now let me say, we see that lived out with Jesus. What's the accusation made against Jesus? That he seems to be at every party. He seems to always be eating and drinking, always finding joy in the ordinary everyday gifts of his Father. You take even his prayer that he teaches his disciples, where he teaches them to pray for their daily bread. And the idea is if you pray for it, you'll also thank God that you receive it. See, simple everyday things. And Jesus doesn't grumble about his work. He sees it as a way of serving others. It's not a means to an end to secure his reputation. It is a gift from God to enable him to serve. Now in Jesus, God steps into the world and he shows us what this wise life looks like. And he says those words to his disciples, "Follow me. Live like that." God gives us good gifts to receive and enjoy each and every day. The preacher says to us, God's goodness is found where you are now. Not in the past, exclusively. Not in the future, exclusively. But right where you are. But we will only find joy in it if we are apprenticed by death. If we look the real world in the eye, so that we look to God as the source of both the gifts and of happiness. Notice verse 26 ends with two different views of life. To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. You see what he's saying as he concludes this little section? The person who knows God is not immune from Eden's ruin. At times, they will cry out, "I hate life." But they also find contentment and joy because they recognize the ordinary, everyday, now gifts of their loving Father. You can live that way, or you can live the way of the sinner, someone who does not know God, who takes God out of the equation, who is restlessly seeking and searching and hoarding and accumulating, who is hiding from death, making sure they're distracted with other things, but ultimately is only chasing the wind, is only filling the bucket that has the hole in the bottom. Which are we? Can we clap along with the preacher? Clap along with the Saviour? Where do we find our happiness and our joy so that we are liberated to enjoy the now that God gives us?